Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine, and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. We start off this hour's programs with Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. They will be followed by dialogue. The program looks at the most important conversations between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of the other Islamic faith and sects. After that, we have our radio productions feature. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Ulema's Speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars.
Thank you for joining us. The Hebrew media focused on the dimensions of the attack on the southern suburb of Beirut and the escalating aggression against Lebanon. It also focused on Iran and on the indictment filed against Israelis accused of spying for Iran. Meanwhile, the issue of the occupied West Bank was present in the comments of Israeli analysts, in addition to the situation in Syria. These topics will be the focus of discussion in this episode with Dr. Mohsen Saleh, President of the International Association of Political Experts, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohsen.
Thank you for having me.
The Israeli aggression on the southern suburb of Beirut was the subject of commentary in the Hebrew media. Amos Yedlin, former head of the military intelligence directorate in the Israeli army, affirmed that striking the southern suburb is a multidimensional message. Amos Yedlin believes that the attack that took place yesterday on the southern suburbs of Beirut is a message not only to Hezbollah, but also to the Lebanese government.
Well, what he is saying is a tautological statement, and he is not knowing what does that mean for the resistance. Resistance, of course, they are proud of having this relationship with Iran. They are proud of these leaders, that they offspring many of these leaders for the future. And in 2008, when they killed the martyr Imad Mughniyi, Sayyid Nasrallah, may peace be upon his soul, said that there are tens of thousands that they benefit from this martyrdom. And I guess now it's a symbolic, true, it's a symbolic for the resistance. They have to pay attention that it is a resistance and it is a revolution. It is an ambience that would yield into a new way of thinking, especially at this time. When you stop, make the silence, recollect and regain your power. That means the Israelis, they have had this zone before 2000, and they were broken and they were defeated. And now it will be the same. They should not give themselves this benefit or this symbolic operation.
But from the enemy side of you, what's the message that they wanted
the
to send with yesterday's escalation in the attacks?
Remind our viewers,
military actions did not stop since the ceasefire took action in South Lebanon. However, yesterday, for the first time, Southern Lebanon is targeting.
Well, it's true.
They are challenging
the government.
Beirut.
They are helping these people who are calling the Hezbollah and the resistance in order to disarm themselves or to disarm with the Lebanese army.
To put pressure.
But that will not work. That will not work. Since the more you increase your attacks and aggressions against Lebanon, the more the people in Lebanon, they will raise their voice in order to resist and in order to help the resistance to continue. They are weak in their mentality, the Israelis and their allies, that they don't know that the more they have pressure on the resistance, the more the people, they don't see any peace, they don't see any tranquility, they don't see any kind of, let's to say, negotiations, as the president, the Lebanese president said. But the people in Lebanon, they have saved themselves by the resistance. They have worked hard for tens of years in order to regain the power in the region and in Lebanon. And they will not submit. They will not surrender.
Okay.
They have to continue. They have. It's their destiny. It's their way of thinking. It's their example, historical example. That's the cultural meaning of the resistance.
Okay, so staying
now,
in the same
now
context.
The Israelis, they can
yes.
do nothing. Of course, they can assassinate, they can kill, they can damage, they can horrify people, but they cannot pursue, they cannot demonate the area in Lebanon or in the south.
But staying in the same context, the Hebrew media confirmed that the Israeli aggression on the southern suburb of Beirut was carried out with a U.S. approval. It stated that the United States canceled the scheduled visit of the Lebanese army commander to Washington. It's obvious from this report that Washington gave the green light to the Israelis to launch the attack that we witnessed yesterday in the southern suburb of Beirut. What are the implications of that? At times, even the Israelis believe that Washington sponsors the Lebanese president.
Well, Washington is leading the whole expedition in Gaza and in Lebanon. And whoever thinks other than that will be mistaken. The Lebanese government, they have bet on this government in order to disarm what they say. They want a sedition. They want a fight inside Lebanon. And Tom Barrack said it clearly that we arm the Lebanese army in order to disarm Hezbollah and to have fight with its people. And
not
Hezbollah,
against Israel.
Yeah, not against Israel, of course. This is natural, absolute, because the United States want to dominate the region by using the force of the Israelis, because they are 1,000 shipment to the Israeli entity, and they have continued to declare that they are anti-Lebanese who are trying to fight to liberate or to say they're even to raise their voice for their freedom. So let's say that the Americans are trying to do so, but the Lebanese government, they cannot do that, because the Lebanese, most of the Lebanese, 50% at least of the Lebanese people, they disagree with the government in order to find peace inside. You cannot fight inside and say we want peace. You have to keep a peaceful environment inside in order to reach a dialogue that would facilitate the way or pave the way for the government in order to make some kind of, development, try to rebuild
the visit of the army personnel, the last moment, because article that was present, they did not condemn Hezbollah. Do you think, Dr. Mohsen, that the Americans who encourage, as we have seen, and also support the ongoing Israeli attacks on Lebanon, might take escalatory actions in the coming days as a way to pressure the Lebanese government?
They might.
To disarm Hezbollah.
They might, but the Lebanese government cannot do more than what they are doing. They have this kind of commonalities, they have this kind of common terms with the resistance and with the leadership of Hezbollah and with the Shiites in order to keep the dignity and ownership of the people who protect it and who are embracing the government, the resistance. So let's to say, whatever the Americans and the Israelis try to force and to put pressure on the Lebanese government and on Lebanon in order to submit, and that would not work. That's useless. That will go nowhere.
Okay.
But the Lebanese resistance is still trying to keep some kind of power in order to protect itself.
Okay.
Despite
the fact that Lebanese President Dr. Mohsen Shaw assistance 24 hours prior to the attack that happened yesterday, assistance and as in, he said that we are ready for negotiations.
Yeah.
And he was waiting the American response towards that.
He was waiting
and then
for
the attack occurred. So what's the message
Israeli,
Israel wanted to send?
And the Israeli response, because these two are trying to find a way that Lebanon would go for the Abrahamic,
accord.
But Lebanon said it clearly that we cannot go for such kind of accord before we make sure that most of the Arabs or all the Arabs have agreed or have approved on this kind of covenant, because it's a new covenant.
Yes.
They are trying to impose that on the Arabs to empower the Israelis, because the Israelis are finding themselves that they are weak. They cannot confront the region. The peoples in the region now are aware of their self-identity.
Okay. Before
so
before
they
ending
have to
this,
do that. The
yes,
resistance
excuse me, Dr.
is
Mohsen,
representing the
time.
Peoples.
Yes. Okay. Before closing this very important subject, do you think that the aggressive attack that happened yesterday in southern Beirut will actually lead to an explosion of the situation and the return to war in Lebanon?
No. I don't think so. We're not going back to war. The Lebanese government is aware of these plots against Lebanon, and the president's speech in Tir, in Sur, that has many indications and connotations in order to say, well, we are in Lebanon, in the south, and the north, in Beirut, in the capital, wherever we are,
okay.
We are trying to unite ourselves in order to face the problems we have.
Okay.
It's not a problem of occupation only. It's a problem of continuing the march for state, to make state. We don't have state. We have to make state.
I have to move on to the third subject for today. Netanyahu's setting foot on occupied areas in southern Syria is still a focus of Hebrew media, particularly regarding the meanings and messages that Netanyahu sent. Is Israel's primary objective behind occupying Syria is to prevent the expansion of a Turkish influence?
Not only the Turkish influence.
Because that's the last statement that the commentator highlighted.
The Arab influence in Syria and the Iranian and the Russians and the people who think, the Israelis think that they are anti-Israel or anti-Americans. So the Israelis, well, here in Lebanon, they should consider that what's happening in Syria, that in spite of all these facilitations for the Israelis army in South Syria, they are still continuing in order to have aggressions in all Syria. And that's why the Lebanese and the Syrians should combine their efforts in order to confront, to try to combat, to combat the Israeli greediness for more occupation or for more invasion in Syria and in Lebanon. Here we are on the crossroad.
Mm-hmm.
If we obey the American and the Israeli strategy for the region,
yes.
that means there are no Arabs.
Okay, we
there
remain
is
in
no
Syria.
Palestine.
Okay, we remain in Syria, where the Hebrew media reflected an atmosphere of Israeli discontent over what they called the al-Julani's attempts to establish a Russian and Turkish security presence in Syria to protect him and stabilize his rule. What problem would Israel have with an enhanced Russian presence in Syria?
Well, first of all, the Israelis have a kind of relationship with the Russians and even with the Turks. But both or all of them, they should understand that there are Syrians there in South Syria. And in Lebanon, there are Lebanese in South Lebanon. There is no right in any law, in the international law, for the Israelis to occupy here or there, in South Syria or in South Lebanon.
Yes.
Whatever they do, the Israelis are really playing in that playground in Syria, where there are no Syrian forces in Golan or in Quneitra or in South or in Suwaida even or in Daraa. So the Israelis are playing there, are making new game in order to rule Syria, all Syria. And they want to have negotiations with the Russians and the Turks in order to have a part or in charge in the Syrian political
scene. But why would Al-Julani want to establish a Russian existence or a Turkish influence or a presence inside Syria at times that he visited Washington and he was aiming to gain the protection of Washington? Do you think that that was a failure? That's why he's looking for different regional countries to protect him against any Israeli threat, or he doesn't care about that?
Well, the Syrians want to have a kind of independence, but Julani knows that he was brought to the authority in Syria by the help of the Turks and the Americans and the Israelis.
Okay.
So that's why they are going in this manner. The Russians, because of their influence in the international arena, now the Russians, they came back and they have interests in Syria, in the shore, or in South Syria.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis, they have no problem in in the Russian existence or military existence in Syria, but on one condition, that won't prevent the Israelis from influencing or executing their political scene in Syria, and will have no enemy in Syria.
Okay, a growing number of indictments are being issued in the Israeli entity against Israelis accused of spying for Iran. The latest development is what the Hebrew media revealed about the arrest of a soldier working in one of Israel's most important military bases on charges of spying for Iran. How damaging are such cases to the Israelis?
Well, since they are talking about this this case, spying against what they call their state, well, that will penetrate their security zone in order to give some information, and the Iranians were able to get some information about many sites, nuclear or military or intelligence or even scientific or military spots. So we are talking about exchanging the role in trying to spy against each other. Well, the Israelis have had a lot of these cases in Iran. And the Iranians, I guess, they have not only the right, but they have to go into spying against the Israelis.
Okay, this topic, actually, Dr. Mohsen, meanwhile, was also raised by Israeli commentators on social media.
Rui, it's astonishing how many Israelis are willing to sell their country to Iran for a few thousand shekels. Every week a new spy is discovered. This is frightening. Nitzan, Israel has lost its intelligence superiority. Today Iran can penetrate us easily. Zirab, Smotrich suggests executing the Jews who worked for Iran. I have a question. Does this also apply to the Jews who worked for Qatar?
Dr. Mohsen, unfortunately, our time is up. You're the president of International Association of Political Experts. Thank you very much for joining us in today's episode.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
we have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So there's a very interesting conversation that occurs between one of the founders of the Islamic schools of thought, specifically the Ahlul Sunnah school of thought, and the founder's name is Abu Hanifa. And so he is the founder of the Hanafi school of thought within the Ahlul Sunnah brothers and sisters. Now, the Hanafi school of thought is also the school of thought which has the most followers in the Ahlul Sunnah brothers. The large majority of our Sunni brothers and sisters are from the Hanafi school of thought. So somebody interestingly asked Abu Hanifa about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And we find that Abu Hanifa had said to one of his companions that it was his honor to have been one of the students of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And so the companion asked, you know, Abu Hanifa, that how is it possible that you consider it to be an honor? And were you actually a student of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam? And so Abu Hanifa, he declared that without these 2 years, he means the 2 years that he studied under Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and this is what one of the Sunni scholars by the name of Al-Alusi, he says that these 2 years are the 2 years that Abu Hanifa studied under Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that without these 2 years there would be no Nu'man. So Nu'man is the given name of Abu Hanifa. So pretty much here, Abu Hanifa is saying that his 2 years that he studied under Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is, you know, what gave him the relative expertise in the, you know, jurisprudential aspects. And so it's interesting, you know, he also stated that I have never seen anyone more knowledgeable in jurisprudence than Ja'far ibn Muhammad. And so, again, it's, you know, incredibly interesting that we find yet another one of the founders of the Sunni jurisprudential school of thought who is, you know, once again, very clearly, very frankly, very openly stating the expertise of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It really, you know, goes to show the incredible expertise and perfection of Imam as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Of course, these are divinely appointed, divinely ordained. They are helped by the Almighty. They are given wisdom and knowledge by the Almighty Allah. And so this is how you see that in no place is it the other way around, where Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has talked about the expertise of so-and-so. Rather, it is the experts of the fiqh and jurisprudential field of the Islamic world that point towards the expertise of the sixth divinely appointed imam. This is Dialogue, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
The Imam alayhi salam taught his companions to respect diversity. Yes, have dialogue with other people. Get to know other schools of thought. It's okay, but hold on to your religion and show them the beauty of your path. This is a beautiful lesson that the Imam alayhi salam gives us. Now, unfortunately, many of us don't implement it in our era. We live in a society, believe me, most fellow Americans, they have no clue what we believe in. I myself, I've witnessed it. When they hear the teachings of Quran, Islam, the teaching of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, they are moved. They are moved. Just a few months ago, I came to a high school here in Toledo. One of the dear brothers had arranged for the visit. And you just speak to them minutes about Islam. And believe me, not deep philosophy. Simple things, what we believe in. They're inspired. Just look at the looks on their faces. Is that what you believe in? Is that what Ramadan represents? And they asked questions and they were so intrigued. They have no clue what we believe in. Believe me, most people in our country, in our society, they're not aware of the gems that you have. Go out and share them. That's how I honor the legacy of Al-Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Take these treasures and go out there in society and share these treasures with them. But yes, this requires that I know what the treasures are. The problem is, some of us, some families, we don't even know what treasures we have from Al-Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. That's why it's challenging. But let's discover these gems and share them with our society. And my dear brothers and sisters, don't be shy and have a, you know, and have weak self-confidence. No, I don't want them to know that I'm Muslim. I don't want to have this conversation with them. They are interested in knowing what you believe in. Learn the basics of Islam, articulate them well, and they will enjoy hearing about Islam. Believe me, some of them, they tell me, we can sit here for hours and hours and just learn about your faith and what you believe in. Because this is amazing knowledge that they don't necessarily have. Share it with your society. That's what the Imam alayhi salam would do. He would educate a generation. of scholars, and he dispatched them to different societies. Go, sit with the people, talk about different subjects, it's okay. And that's how the Imam alayhi salam preserved the teachings of his grandfather Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of your door, and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying for everyone.
news related to the Group of Seven is always controversial. At the annual meetings of the seven industrial nations, important issues are discussed. Topics such as political decisions, economic problems, and climate challenges. These countries, which control 60% of the world's economy, seek solutions to crises that threaten not only their own populations, but the lives of all inhabitants of the planet. For this reason, the G7 summit carries great significance for news agencies and scientific circles. Months in advance, experts and journalists propose subjects to draw the attention of policymakers. The events of 2013 were of this same nature, a year in which the G7 summit differed markedly from previous years. Given the circumstances of that time, it would not have been surprising if experts had recommended focusing on climate change, the economic crisis following 2008, or the Syrian war and the rise of Daesh, but that was not the case. For example, one British expert took a different stance. Professor Sally Davis, the UK government's health advisor, released a striking report, a report she considered more important than terrorism or climate change. The subject of her report was antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In a stark warning, Davis declared, "Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is like a ticking time bomb." When Hitler spread the flames of war across Europe, countless soldiers were sent to the front. Many were transferred to field hospitals, where doctors once again relived the bitter memories of the First World War. The infected wounds of thousands of soldiers had to be treated, not only to save their lives, but because politicians needed every single one of them to secure victory in the war. The only thing that could meet this need was antibiotics, and the only entities capable of producing them in vast quantities were governments. The warring states pressured pharmaceutical companies, and the process of antibiotic production began. The process, by keeping human forces alive, was able to change the course of the war. In the mid-20th century, just before antibiotics were mass-produced for humans, another development occurred. Researchers announced that this drug could first and foremost transform food production and human food security. Until then, the production of food products was not subject to specific health regulations. And in some countries, traditional methods of production meant that bacteria entered the human body along with food. The discovery of antibiotics changed this process, and researchers proposed their use in the livestock and poultry industry. The industry for years had struggled with widespread animal deaths and diseases, problems that limited meat production and kept its price high. But antibiotics worked like a miracle.
That most farms won't let cameras in. But one in North Georgia agreed, as long as we didn't reveal its name.
What's your big goal?
The farm's veterinarian, Chuck Hoffaker, showed me how antibiotics have become essential to industrial-scale farming.
My big goal is to prevent disease.
It is like a small city, isn't it?
Yes, because once they get sick, just as in a city, the disease can then spread through the population fairly quickly.
This is what Hoffaker wants to prevent.
This chicken was sick because of an intestinal disease.
So this is a signal to you that it's time to use an antibiotic to prevent this from spreading.
That's correct.
Chuck, what do we have here?
Well, this is an antibiotic called lincomycin.
Antibiotics like this are regularly put in the drinking water or added to the feed of healthy animals, most of the time without a prescription.
Empty the antibiotic into the water. Water coming out of this bucket with the antibiotic will be injected into their water, and then that water will then go on into the chicken house and will be at the proper dosage.
It's estimated that as much as 70% of all antibiotics sold in the United States go to farms.
They drink out of these nipples, and they eat from these feeders, and that helps the flock grow better. The farmer does better because they have more pounds of meat, give the consumer a cheaper food supply. The chickens are healthier, so healthy chickens mean a healthier product for the consumer as well.
But increasingly, this widespread use of antibiotics in animals has been raising concerns.
Is it possible that there's a pathway? I'm thinking particularly of resistance, you know. Could it go in bugs from the chicken house to the family table?
We don't know how often that occurs. We think that it probably occurs at a very, very low rate.
Sally Davis's recommendation to the leaders of the G7 about the current state of humanity pointed precisely to this issue: bacterial resistance to antibiotics. She considered the crisis to consist of two main parts: direct consumption and indirect consumption. From Davis's remarks, it was clear that the meat reaching people was saturated with antibiotics, drugs administered either by injection or through feed, which soon entered the human stomach along with the meat. The crisis that had emerged in the livestock industry was, in fact, a crisis for human bodies as well. The meat was contaminated with bacteria that no antibiotic could destroy. Bacteria transmitted directly into humans. Yet this was only one side of the coin. Figures like Davis believed the greater danger lay in direct consumption of antibiotics, a widespread practice whose statistics grew daily. A mistaken belief persisted in popular culture that antibiotics were harmless and always healing. Patients were pleased if they could persuade doctors to prescribe the drug, and if not, they resorted to self-medication. Britain's Public Health Agency reports that in the industrial nation alone, more than 20% of antibiotic prescriptions are unnecessary. Globally, the figure ranges between 30 and 50%. The unnecessary prescriptions made Davis's crisis appear all more serious: the crisis of antibiotic resistance. Meat saturated with antibiotics, excessive prescriptions, and self-medication form the three sides of the crisis. A dangerous, deadly triangle for the inhabitants of Earth. With each passing day, bacteria grow more resistant to antibiotics. At present, 2 million people each year suffer infections solely because bacteria have become resistant. In England, 7% of annual deaths are due to infections. Simple infections that half a century ago would have been eliminated by a basic antibiotic, but which now have become a serious threat. A threat that, it is said, will be more dangerous than cancer by 2050.
I first heard about David's case in July of 2011. I was sitting in my office doing some work, and one of my colleagues, an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Doug Smith, gave me a call and asked me if I had known about a patient up on one of our acute care floors with a number of drug-resistant pathogens. I brought up his medical record, and saw a huge amount of drug resistance. Drug resistance we don't typically see.
All these R's mean that the bacteria is resistant to that antibiotic.
I get this knock on my door, and they open up the door, and there's these doctors. They tell me, we need to isolate you. We need to put you on your own and quarantine you.
Drug-resistant bacterial infections are on track to kill more people than cancer.
By 2050, superbugs could kill 10 million people a year.
Now we are seeing bacteria that are resistant to the absolute last stop on the train, colistin. And so for those patients, there are no options left. So those patients are truly have gone back in time. They are back in the pre-antibiotic era, and they will recover from those infections or will die from those infections, and there's nothing we can do for them.
We may reach a point where no antibiotic is effective even against the simplest infections. We may return to the conditions before the 20th century, and history may repeat itself. This was precisely Davis's warning that carried a troubling question. She emphasized that for 25 years, no new antibiotic had been developed, a strange fact that directly targeted pharmaceutical companies. The reason for this is not very complicated. Although antibiotic consumption is high, the crucial issue is the enormous cost of developing one. Estimates suggest that if a company wants to create a new antibiotic, it must spend around $1.5 billion, while its annual market sales would yield only about $50 million in profit. For the past three decades, pharmaceutical companies have refused to produce antibiotics for purely financial reasons. They prefer to invest their money in other products. Each year, their research and development divisions introduce new cosmetic drugs. Botox compounds, baldness treatments, prosthetics, bodybuilding hormones, and vitamins. The funds that could have gone into antibiotic development are instead spent on such items. The few drugs that are produced are not created with therapeutic goals in mind, but with the same profit-driven approach. The development of diabetes and blood pressure medications has only one reason. Unlike antibiotics, these drugs must be taken daily and for the patient's entire lifetime, creating an industry that guarantees long-term revenue for companies. That is why pharmaceutical corporations have no answer to the concern of critics. It is said that one of the main ways to confront the current crisis is to develop new antibiotics. But this is not something that the owners of pharmaceutical companies are willing to accept. They prefer to think of their own profits rather than the consequences of their actions. The consequences became more evident than ever in 2020, a tense year that confirmed the truth of earlier warnings.
The sense that you have to make some very ruthless decisions about where to put the company's capital, about where to invest, where to put your emphasis. And when you pulled out of gram-negative research like that and shifted to vaccines, do you look back on that and say, you know, we learned something about this?
These are not ruthless decisions. These are, you know, portfolio decisions about how we can serve medical need in the best way. We want to stay, you know, in the business of providing new therapeutics for the future. Our investors require that of us. I think society wants a Pfizer to be doing what we do in 20 years. We make portfolio management decisions.
There is an increasing recognition that antibiotics are not a good thing to run off a pure capitalistic market, okay? We need to switch from an entrepreneurial business model where you maximize sales to other payer mechanisms, where the goal is society can say, we want these kinds of antibiotics developed, and we're going to help you out. We're going to decrease your cost and risk. In return, on the back end, we're going to have some say in how it's used so it doesn't get abused.
When news arrived that a strange virus had spread from Wuhan, China, no one imagined what would happen in the weeks ahead. At first, COVID-19 was not taken seriously. Yet, within just 3 months, it placed the busiest cities in the world under total quarantine. The global economy faced crisis, and one social upheaval after another became apparent. There was no clear prospect for vaccine development, and politicians tried to speculate about the origin of the virus. Although the source of COVID-19 remains uncertain, transmission from animals to humans is considered one of the serious hypotheses. Some link it to human interference in the environment, while others believe its spread resembles that of SARS, MERS, and Ebola, dangerous viruses that in recent decades have disrupted the course of human life. Precisely at a time when no new antibiotic had been developed and the overuse of existing drugs had peaked, the outbreak of COVID-19 and the investigation into its origin provided an excuse for the issue of superbugs to resurface. Bacteria that, through continuous mutations, have gained strength and rendered all existing antibiotics ineffective. These bacteria, expected to grow even more powerful in the years ahead, may become a serious threat to the future of humanity. As Davis had said back in 2013, resistance to antibiotics will be even more dangerous than terrorism, something like a ticking time bomb, predicted to claim one life every 3 seconds. COVID-19 was a wake-up call that made the importance of this bomb clearer, a bomb that humanity has little time to defuse. Experts have offered crucial recommendations for the time remaining so that the experience of COVID-19 will not be repeated. Confronting superbugs requires cooperation among politicians, the medical community, and the people of the world. Governments must invest in the development of new antibiotics in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies. Passing laws to reduce the use of these drugs in the livestock industry is the next step. The medical community must minimize antibiotic prescriptions so that they can regain their original effectiveness. Changing the culture of medicine among humans is also one of the most important conditions for overcoming the crisis. People's attitudes toward antibiotics and their use must change. The belief that all illnesses can be cured with this drug is a mistaken notion of recent decades. A belief that new experiments have proven false.
Dr. Chris Wired is one of the last working ethnopharmacologists, who are scientists who go into the wilderness to look for plants that can be turned into medically viable drugs in humans' ongoing war against disease.
The last hope for human race survival, I believe, is in the rainforest of tropical Asia. The pharmaceutical wealth of this land is immense. A jungle is not a peaceful environment. Trees fight with trees. Trees fight with insects. They all fight and communicate, and they use chemicals, and we are looking for those chemicals. But we have no time. What could happen if we've got major pandemias, millions of deaths? This is no joke. It is now or never. We don't break it, right?
Right, yeah.
We just bought that guy. Slow. Okay, that's great. Can someone take a piece of the stem there?
Just very carefully taking some branches off a tree in hopes of curing mankind of disease.
Okay, can I have that guy here? All right. Okay, we've got something interesting here. This is an absolute sign of Rubiaceae family. That plant contains alkaloid. That one is a very rare one. We're going to make some collections of that guy. My sixth sense to me is we've got something.
Yeah.
That's a great time we've done.
Have you seen this plant before?
Never.
In the jungle?
Yeah,
no,
never.
It's the first time.
That's a good one.
Wow.
Wonderful.
The book Bald's Leech Book proved that the way to fight bacteria was the same old method. By turning to this manuscript, doctors were able to arrive at a new combination for a plant-based antibiotic, a potent remedy that, as in the past, could eliminate infections. They continue to recommend the development of new antibiotics and the reduction of current drug use, but their new outlook is a return to nature. Now there is talk of antibiotic properties of algae, as well as discussions about the therapeutic effects of honey and its potential as a substitute for synthetic drugs. These are natural methods of escaping the antibiotic trap, a drug that not long ago was humanity's bait for hunting bacteria, but has now become a trap of death, a trap as numerous as the inhabitants of the earth.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.